Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Riddles in the Dark. This is the big one, the one you've been waiting for, where we'll be talking about the ending. We've been putting this off for like months now, I feel like. So finally we're getting around to it. This is going to be exciting. These are the questions that really, like, that people seem to always focus on when we do our retrospectives and when we're tallying things up and when people are watching. This is one of the fun ones. So we're excited to finally get to it. And since we have a hard stop today, let's jump right in. I am your co-host, Dave Kale, and with me, as always, are the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson, and Trish Lambert. Good morning.
Good morning.
I love how your energy, like, jumped, like, exponentially from the between the time we were not on the air and on the air. I got it.
Hey,
you know, that's
radio.
Actually very praiseworthy, yes.
You got to be high energy.
That's right.
That's right.
Very good. So today we're talking about the ending, and what I really want to focus on in discussing the ending of the film is to really be thinking about this in story terms. Because, you see, it would be very easy for the discussion of the end of the film to be really a pretty trivial discussion. That is to say, it's not necessarily a very important question. It could just sort of be a curiosity. What do you think happens to be the last thing they're going to show or whatever? And many people might think, I suspect, that if there's a topic which, you know, does not really have to do with any, like, analysis of the book, it would be this one, right? We're just going to talking about where they're going to happen to break the story. Obviously, the story in the book is not divided up into three parts like this. So, so this is really just a question about the films entirely and has nothing to do with the books. But I actually don't agree with that. What I think that we really need to be thinking about when we're thinking about the ending is to be thinking about the overall story. This, for me, is, you know, it's one of the reasons I have been wanting to put it off as long as we have, is that looking at the ending really signals to me that we should be stepping back and looking at some really big picture stuff. We've done some slightly bigger picture stuff, like stepped back and looking at the overall trajectory of Thorin's character, the overall trajectory of Bilbo's character, and some of those kinds of things. But here, you know, be thinking about the shape of the story as a whole. And how they're going to be doing. So there are a couple things that I think that we should do as we are approaching this question. One is to be looking at the shape of the story in the book to see how exact, because there are some definite moments. There is a rather, in some ways, rather unusual shape of the Hobbit story in the book. And then we need to be looking at also what was the shape of the story that they told in film one. And what do we think is going to be really accomplished in film two? The end of film one certainly led me to believe that, you know, when they did the revision from two films to three films, you know, they did obviously really think carefully about having the ending points not be simply a cliffhanger to be continued moment, but to be a moment where something has been accomplished, you know, satisfactorily in the story. And I assume that the same is going to be true at the end of film two. So I'd like to think about how they did that in film one and compare it back. But let me start off by talking a little bit about the shape of the story in The Hobbit. I mean, I would say you actually could point to two stopping points. In fact, I think you actually could make a three-part division in the original, in the story of the Hobbit book. And where I would do it, if I were dividing this already kind of small book into a trilogy of much smaller books, where I would divide it is the departure of Gandalf first, the death of the dragon second, and then through to the end of the book. And I point to those two as major transitional points because those are places where the not just the kinds of things that were really the whole premise of the story, I think, really begins to change. The first part of the story is, you know, about Bilbo being taken into the wild, you know, that the crossing of that boundary from his you know, from his domestic world, the way that the dwarves and the wizard especially and this world of adventure comes into his home, and then he's brought out of his home and they transition into the wild, and then he's thoroughly immersed in it with, you know, with the Misty Mountains and with Gollum. The encounter with the eagles and the bears is you know, sort of like this, sort of the final thing. But the Bilbo's own perspective, Bilbo's own sort of world hasn't changed. There is a significant change when he escapes from Gollum. You know, there's that moment at the beginning of chapter 6, I think is very important, where he, you know, where the idea that he has escaped on his own has, you know, has made a big change in him. But but really, when the wizard goes away, that's when the story really changes. And now this becomes, we enter into a new focus of the story, where Bilbo's role with the dwarves is changing, the whole nature of their adventures. This is not just now we're moving from Bag End and into the wild, but now it is Bilbo and the dwarves operating on a more equal footing, still not quite equal, on a more equal footing, you know, immersed in Mirkwood, which is essentially which really dominates the central part of the story, from Mirkwood through to the Lonely Mountain. And Bilbo's, of course, increasing leadership role as he goes from somebody who is not totally pathetic at the beginning to somebody who is really a leader and somebody who is basically doing almost everything and in charge of almost the entire show by the time they get to the end of it, and certainly by the time they're at the Lonely Mountain. But then when the dragon dies, we have another really important transition. And it's not just, you know, there's a moment when Tolkien's narrator kind of comically points to this transition, in fact. That's when the raven comes and tells them that the dragon is dead. And you know, Bilbo is, you know, the narrator tells us that Bilbo is thinking, you know, that with the death of the dragon, the adventure is properly speaking over. You know, Bilbo is like, okay, here we go. Roll credits. Well, no, we can't roll credits yet because I'm not home yet. But it's time for me to go home, right? It's time for us to divvy things up and give me my 14th share and off we go. But of course, as the narrator points out, he was very much mistaken about the fact that the adventure is over. But of course, even more than that, even before that, in the book, we get the chapter that actually describes the death of Smaug, the fire and water chapter. And that's a place where the tone of the book really shifts. The shift of the tone of The Hobbit is something that's been much commented on, and many people, you know, have observed it and said various things about it. How it gets much more dark and much more serious. I actually dislike the adjective dark when applied to stories at all. I find that the way that people use that word is so vague.
You don't find that to be incredibly illuminating and helpful?
Oh, my goodness. No, I don't. Sometimes, because some people mean lots of evil things happen. Some people mean lots of violence occurs when they say dark. Some people mean, you know, what I would mean by dark would be something like, you know, a kind of, you know, George R. R. Martin
occurs at night,
anti-hero kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But even if only because so many people mean so many different things by that adjective when they apply it to a story, I find it not very useful. Because certainly I find the end of The Hobbit not dark in that sense. You know, it is not like the, you know, Game of Thrones breaks out at the end of The Hobbit. That's just not what happens. But it does get more grown up. It does get more, the tone does change, gets less comical. You know, you go back to chapter one and you read, you know, something like the Battle of Five Armies, and then you go back and reread chapter one, the difference in tone is very clear. Tolkien is going out of his way to make things funny, even serious things, especially serious things. He doesn't back away from scary stuff. You know, his description of the Sack of Dale and the Lonely Mountain in chapter one is, you know, I mean, it's a sufficiently horrific event, but the way that it's phrased is played for laughs, so that he really persistently diffuses the horrifying things with comedy in chapter one. He stops doing that at the end of the book. And even, you know, the part to me, and I mentioned this in my book, the part to me that really jumps out at the end of the chapter, the end of the Fire and Water, is not just the description of the fight with Smaug, but the way that the narrator goes out of his way to tell us how many people in Lake Town died. And what's more, to tell us how many more were going to die of hunger and exposure over the course of the winter that was coming. We don't need to know that exactly. I mean, that would have been easy to skip over. The dragon's dead. Hooray! Back to the mountain, right? I mean, it's completely and yet he goes out of his way to really draw the reader into the situation, the suffering of the people of Lake Town, and how awful it was, and how many of them have died, and all of them are homeless. So that's, you know, and we get that from then on. You know, we get descriptions not only of the corpses lying around the battlefield, but, you know, the horrible, gruesome descriptions of, like, the vampire bats, fixing themselves and drinking the blood of the dead on the battlefield. It's pretty awful. And again, in tone, nothing like what we were getting back in chapter one. So it's not just that the story enters a different phase and develops a different focus when the primary quest of this book has happened, you know, has been completed. That is, we're going to go back to the Lonely Mountain, recover our treasure, and ideally kill the dragon. Well, now the dragon's dead. They have the treasure and they're in the Lonely Mountain. But now there's this whole extra segment of the story. So it's not just the fact that the story carries on and adds on this extra story of the Siege of the Lonely Mountain and then ultimately the Battle of Five Armies. But also, you get this change of tone, this change of attitude, this change of interest. Now I'm not saying in saying these things that I would predict that such a change would happen necessarily in the films. One thing, of course, about the films is that they've incorporated that much more from the beginning. We don't get the same, even though there is much comedy being employed in the first Hobbit film, it is not the kind of, you know, children's story comedy that it has all of the seriousness of the end of The Hobbit from the very beginning, especially in the character of Thorin. I think of that moment in film one where Thorin comes in and is like a complete buzzkill to the party at Bag End. Thorin is always serious, and everybody is always serious around Thorin. And you see, in this way, the film does exactly the opposite of what Tolkien did in chapter one. Tolkien jokes most with the most serious stuff in chapter one of The Hobbit. Like, whenever he's talking about something really sad or really gruesome, he goes out of his way to make a joke of it or to make light of it in some way. Whereas, again, in film one, we get lots of comedy around the sides, but then we pause for, again, everybody's having fun at Bag End, and then Thorin comes in, and now everybody's really serious. Or, you know, Feely and Keely are messing around at the campsite, and then Balin sobers things up by telling the story of the Battle of As-Sin-Ulbazar. We're not having fun with those things. There's no comedy connected to the Battle of As-Sin-Ulbazar. So again, that kind of seriousness is already implicit in the films from the beginning. So I don't necessarily expect the story to really change its tone at the end, especially since, again, they've been anticipating it. I mean, the kind of conflict which is going to almost erupt in the Battle of Three Armies between the dwarves and elves and men, but then which is at the last second superseded by the Battle of Five Armies. That uh, that tension, again, it's already been there. From the beginning, it's already been there. So there's no, you know, this is not a new element which gets introduced here at the end. So I wouldn't really predict that the film would go in that direction. But again, you know, thinking about the way that the book story is divided, the different kind of movements, I want to say, that happen within the Hobbit story. It's interesting to me to think about that in connection with the film. Now, you'll notice film one actually ends very close to where I would put the first major division or the first major transition in the Hobbit story. It ends at the Carrick, whereas it's on the other side of Beorn's house that I think the transition of the story really happens. But that, I think, is an interesting thing. You'll notice the difference here. In the book, Tolkien has this transition with the departure of the wizard. When Gandalf ceases to be the one, I mean, he's the story maker, right? That's how Gandalf is introduced at the beginning. Wherever Gandalf, goes, these tales and adventures spring up out of the grass. That's what Gandalf does. That's who Gandalf is. But he's the one who brings him. I said, you know, the first part of the book is like that transition, that Bilbo being drawn into the wild. Well, that's what Gandalf does. He's their guide. He takes them in. Once he gets them into the wild, he leaves them there. And now it's time for them to have their own adventure and for them to find their own way. And again, he leaves them there for no good reason. And I mean that quite literally. When Gandalf departed in the book, Tolkien, the author, had no idea where Gandalf was going. You know, he did not have a plan for that. He just wanted to get rid of Gandalf to leave Bilbo and the dwarves on their own. So again, it's all about the role of Gandalf and Gandalf's relationship with the story. In the film, the choice of the moment at the end of film one, you know, the choice of that moment to break the films at the Carrick is clearly not about, has nothing to do with Gandalf, and it has everything to do with Thorin and Bilbo. And with both of them individually, as well as both of them together, that is this, you know, we've seen Thorin as this kind of angry, embittered character, focused on vengeance from the beginning. In a sense, the man hug between Thorin and Bilbo that happens on the Carrick this is the culminating moment. And this is clearly a moment of transition for Thorin, that he has decided to accept Bilbo and to believe in Bilbo. And we have the still unresolved, I would say, and it's one of the things I'm going to be really watching for in film two, the unresolved significance of the apparent, the loss of his oaken shield at the end of film one, you know, when, because the camera lingers on that, right? When the eagle picks him up and takes him away, and you know, that piece of oaken log that he's been carrying around ever since the Battle of Azan-ul-Bazar drops and he leaves it behind. And that, since that's his namesake, you've got to think that that's an important symbolic moment for Thorin's character. And I still don't quite know how that's going to play in film two and exactly what the symbol. I need to see a little bit more of the after before I can really come to any conclusion about what the symbolic significance of that moment in film one was. But anyway, you've clearly got the important transition of Thorin. But then with Bilbo as well, of course, you know, we've seen him grow, and we have his speech before they meet the wolves, after they reunite coming out of the mountains, and then, you know, followed up by his actions in saving Thorin's life from the goblins. So, you know, it's ending that they chose, you know, the way that they did the ending of film one was a satisfying moment, certainly in as far as those two character arcs are concerned. It feels like something has been accomplished, and now, you know, but they're obviously looking, you know, the film is still obviously looking ahead to all of what remains to them. But again, I think it's interesting that Gandalf, unlike in the book, Gandalf is not really involved in that. It's just about Bilbo and Thorin's development. What do you guys think about the overall sort of arc of film two. Having ended with that, having ended with, you know, with, in that sense, I think you could say sort of the primary story of film one being the development of the, first of all, do you agree with me that Bilbo and Thorin are really the focal point of the ending of film one?
Yes, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So, what do you think about where we're going to be going in film two from this here? What kind of overall trajectory would you guys expect? Like, what do you think is going to be the story of, you know, if film one is this, you know, Bilbo's story and Thorin's story, what's film two going to be?
Well, you know, I think we've touched on this before. I'm expecting to see at least something, you know, a little bit of a Two Towers effect, where when Gandalf leaves, we split the story in two and we kind of flip-flop back and forth. On the Thorin Company, Bilbo side, I think we're going to, you know, continue to see the relationship between Thorin and Bilbo develop in one direction or another. Gandalf, I almost think of the Gandalf storyline as the setup for the Lord of the Rings movies. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm trying to figure out where Gandalf will leave. You know, Gandalf, I'm wondering if Gandalf will leave where he does in the book, you know, on the edges of Mirkwood. So I'm thinking we're going to see the two, you know, there are going to be two branches. One, the Gandalf one might get resolved by the Battle of Dol Guldur by the end of movie two. I don't know.
You're right that there's the Gandalf plot is awkward in that way, because that is a good way to think about it. It is the Gandalf plot, the whole necromancer thing, which is the bridge between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And really, this gets back to a question we've asked lots of times and we don't really have an answer to, though I think we've all expressed our preference that this be minimized. But what connection is there going to be between those two plots, between the Gandalf setup for the Lord of the Rings plot and the mainstream Hobbit plot? Because that's clearly it's not obvious that those two things must interact. But I don't know. It's also going to be a little awkward if they don't at all.
Right. It's an interesting, I guess this question really, the way you've posed this, it's much more interesting than the very simple, like, you know, where's the film going to end? Because what you're really asking is, what story do the filmmakers want to tell in the second film?
Exactly. Because
and it's not just like, oh, well, they're going to tell the story of The Hobbit. But no.
Right. Right, because, you know, that each film, I mean, if it's done well, each film should have its own, you know, its own arc, its own story.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're right to, you know, sort of implying that by asking the question this way, I'm giving the filmmakers the benefit of the doubt, in that, you know, I think if film two is good, this is what it will do. You know, it will have some kind of discrete arc. Though, actually, here's a side question. When they were planning two films, you know, the prevailing wisdom is that the first film was going to end after the barrel ride. So my question is, what was the story of that film going to be? What was going to be, not just thinking of it as a milestone in the overall Hobbit plot, but as an ending to the film one story. We already know something like 2/3 at least of what was going to be the film one story. But now imagining that it doesn't end on the Carrick, but carries on to the, this is why I suspect we're getting a goblin attack, it mixed in with the barrel, ride down the river. Because that must have been the climactic sequence of the original film one, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So that's why we get Azog back again. So thinking about...
It's really funny.
Yeah.
As an aside, That's really funny, because we went back in the day, the long ago days of the two, there will only be two films of this. Can barely remember what that was like. We predicted all along that probably the split would be at arriving in Lake Town, and that the last scenes would be them going down the river. But we always imagined it would be like the climactic scene would be escaping from the elves, and then yes. We would just get this closing shot of some barrels yes. bobbing on the river and pan out to the mountain. We never imagined that the final shot of the movie would be a chase scene with aerial barrel battles. And
exactly, yeah. Bomber being launched out of a trebuchet and a barrel fighting improbably a goblin in midair. Yes, we did not expect that. But it does make
Now, you know, I was talking to you before we did the show about the fact that as I'm recalling, the original name of the last movie was Battle of Five Armies. And wasn't there a point in time when it was actually announced that that was the name of the movie, or was it just that they registered that and they hadn't really officially announced that that was the name of it?
I don't think they made an official announcement.
Oh, okay. So it was just one of the names they registered. And
yeah.
It wasn't actually officially the name. Because I was thinking if that was the case, that kind of would give us the clue as to what they were going to focus on in the last movie.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting idea. Kate is suggesting, do you think the original ending would have been Toriel saying, "It is our fight"? That's interesting. Kate, it really makes me wonder what side of the original divide would that scene have fallen. It's going to be hard, you know, when we see the film, it might become obvious one way or the other. We don't really know when in the sequence of the film that conversation between her and Legolas takes place. But it would be interesting to see that. There's so many variables involved with that. I'm not really sure. But thinking back to the wild action sequence, apparent ending of original film one that we were just talking about, what was going to be accomplished there? What was going to be accomplished there was, because Azog's going to be involved. It's going to be Azog and his goblins again. It's the goblins of Azog that Bomber is fighting in midair, right? I think.
Right. Okay. Yes. Right.
Presumably.
Presumably, because we see Azog coming in and attacking elves, on the way through in the trailer. So we've got another climax with Azog, which means, again, thinking back to original film one, we have the story of the Battle of Azanul Bazar, I guess, and we have, I say I guess, because who knows what they expanded when they moved from 2 to 3, but anyway. We get, I guess the scene of Azog on Weathertop saying, you know, let's like hunt them down. And then we get the out of the frying pan into the fire sequence when the two fight, but Azog and Thorin are both, where they both escape and go their separate ways. And then they come together again. Is this supposed to have been some kind of climax? Could we get the death of Azog in that scene? Could we have gotten that at the end of film one?
Yeah, we might have. That's true.
So that little subplot gets actually is, you know, so that film one becomes in that sense the story of the closure of that earlier sequence, which could have great significance for Thorin's kingship. Thinking this through for a second. Dave, back when we were joking, when we were thinking about the end of the first film as the barrels bobbing down, remember the joke that I made, which I still love, by the way, of having the very, very end of the film be Thorin coming out of the barrel and saying, "Well, I'm back," right? I still think that would be awesome, so I can still use that, but anyway, but the point, the premise of that joke was that the moment of transition between original film one and original film two was Thorin returning to his kingdom. You know, that this is the moment where we don't have a bunch of travelers on a journey. Film one is bunch of travelers on a journey. Then film two of two is The Return of the King, which doesn't go quite the same as the other return of the other king later on. But anyway, the second film is essentially a Return of the King film. That could still, in a sense, now again, we don't get my funny joke ending, but if the film did end with a climactic battle with Azog, which ends with the death of Azog, possibly, that could be a reestablishment. You know, it's on the one hand, Thorin reestablishing his conflict with Azog is associated with his kingship, has been associated with his kingship by Balin's story in film one, the story of the Battle of Azanul.
That's true.
So if, you know, he like sort of reestablishes things, and I mean, it allows for not an anticlimactic entry into Lake Town, but a kind of triumphal entry into Lake Town. You know, I am the king of the mountain. I return, and I just defeated the Pale Orc and, like, you know, finished the business that was left unfinished at the Battle of Azanul Bazaar. And now I'm coming home and we're going to settle with the dragon. You know, that could have been, that could be a direction.
Then it can be more of an Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator "I'm back" moment.
Exactly. I to be back. Yeah.
You know, there's also something about the first film when it was going to be two films, which is our apparently now deleted Bolg. Remember that the old poster and the toys. I mean, I guess Bolg was going to be showing in film one originally, and now he appears to be gone completely. So right. I wonder how that storyline, because I assume that was a Dol Guldur storyline that was going to show up in film one, which we haven't gotten.
Right, yeah. I mean, Chuck is saying he expects Azog to survive film two to be killed by Thorin in the Battle of Five Armies. I mean, that seems likely. And that Azog could give, you know, Thorin his fatal wound. That does seem likely. But exactly, Trish, I was thinking the same thing. When we were going to get Bolg, which I still haven't 100% given up on, but it's not looking good for Bolg at this point.
He's on life support.
Bolg stock is dropping rapidly here. People are selling their Bolg stock right and left. But we had always talked about that since they had originally planned to do both Azog and Bolg, that this was going to be, you know, like a father-son vengeance thing, and that it was going to be Bolg who was, you know, running the Battle of Five Armies, and that was going to be the conflict. So, you know, if they shift, and in some ways, you know, I have to say I like that better. You know, the whole, Azog, the white orc is the pale orc is he's the big recurring villain, and he's just going to be a pretty stock recurring villain and going to have his climactic battle with the hero in the final scenes. I mean, that's pretty trite, you know, in action movie tradition. It doesn't get more predictable than that. And I'm not saying that just doing something different from how things are always done is the best thing. I'm generally resistant to things having to be a surprise or not following, you know, nice traditional, you know, there's something to be said for nice archetypal endings. And it's okay if they've been done before. However, Azog has a chance to be pretty lame, and I know that many people did think he was kind of lame in the first film for this reason, but anyway, Yana says he's still holding out for Dan killing Azog at the doorstep of the Lonely Mountain. Yeah, if he can't kill him on the doorstep of Moria, he can at least kill him on some threshold or other. Yeah.
I'm holding out for him just running along and getting hit by a stray arrow in the middle of the battle.
We're getting clawed by an eagle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Actually, he's menacingly stalking up to an injured Thorin, and then an eagle grabs him and carries him off screaming.
You know, you're actually right. You know, if they keep Bulg in, I mean, you get this father. I think it'd be kind of a cool to have this sort of father son sub theme going on. You know, with Thranduil and Legolas and Bulg and Azog, and you know, you could even have and Thorin and Thrian, and you could even find out that maybe Bard is the illegitimate son of the Master of Lake Town, which of course would change the Bulgarian.
Well, come on, guys, there's not going to be any Bulg. He's gone. Just accept it. Accept it and move on. It's not going to be a Bulg.
Oh,
and we're going way off topic.
That's too bad, because he looks so interesting. Oh, you're right. We're going off topic, and Dave has to go. I know. Okay. Old Bulg. We hardly knew ye.
We didn't get to know you at all, really.
We didn't know you at all, yeah. We saw you. You got
like
5 seconds of screen time. Not even 5 seconds. It was like 2 seconds.
Bulg's Lament, yes. Bulg's Lament. The Lay of Bulg.
Okay. Anyway, no, but I, you know, all of this stuff is okay. The question of how was the original film one going to come to an end, of course, is not directly relevant to this, but it is in the sense of sort of seeing where exactly they were heading, because presumably they're going to hit that on the way. And we're going to get that climactic, if indeed that was the climactic scene, which it rather looks like, we're still going to get that, except it's going to be in the middle. Or maybe the first half. Yeah, probably not the first half. But anyway, it's going to be somewhere in the middle or maybe two-thirds of the way through the second film. So that's going to be kind of interesting to see that transition. One question, and this actually we didn't get a chance to talk about this earlier, but somebody, Chuck, was asking earlier, what incident is going to happen to induce Gandalf to leave, and how will he explain it to the rest of the company?
Well, that's true.
I suggested a telepathic message from Galadriel.
Yeah, or
that's a really good question, because in the book, he's planning to leave all along.
Right. Right.
Because in the book, they've been plotting this attack on Dol Guldur for about 300 years now.
Right. Yeah, though again, I mean, in the 1937 book, he just says, I've got other business.
Right.
And it's clear that, you know, to Gandalf, the trip to the Lonely Mountain is only one of several things he's, you know, got on the burner at this time. And, you know, he's going to go tend to something else. So, yeah, just the fact that it's got to come up explicitly. Gandalf can't just say exactly what he says in the book. You know, he can't just say, I've got other business, which I'm now late to through messing with you people. But we already know what his business is. You know, we get that whole setup in Rivendell in film one. He's got to, and what's more, in one sense, now the departure at the place where he does, at the borders of Mirkwood, actually makes sense, because he's going to go, I got to go to Dol Guldur. You know, I can't go this way. I've got to go a different route because there's something I got to find out now that I'm over here. Our paths were going the same direction up to here, but I've got to, you know, maybe I'll meet up with you again later on, but I got to take off. I say it almost makes sense because, of course, if we get the Tombs of the Nazgul, which were supposed to be way back on the other side of the Misty Mountains, based on what Galadriel said in film one, then we have another moment of fun with geography. But whatever. I'm just kind of trying to ignore that right now. But so, I mean, I think he's got the premise to leave. It's gonna, you know, clearly he's got to make more of a big deal of it. Though again, it leads me to wonder what kind of connection there's going to be between the two stories, and if some connection is going to be established at that moment of Gandalf's departure. Like, that is, I don't think it can just be, okay, you guys keep going, I'm going to go do something totally different. You know, so like, I'm out of here. I don't think that's how it's going to come across when Gandalf talks to, you know, Thorin and Bilbo about it.
Yeah. I don't think, don't think with the film characters being the way they are that Gandalf's going to be able to get away with, I got other things to do. I'll see you.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Brianna reminds us or points out that in the audio clip of Gandalf leaving, he says he's leaving, quote, in search of answers.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. I mean, that's... Gandalf has a good reason for leaving that's been well established in film one. So that's going to be fine. But that's one major way, I think, in which film two has got to differ, is that the stuff with the necromancer, whether or not we get to the Battle of Dol Guldur in film two or not, the stuff of the necromancer has to take a more central place because it interferes with the main story. Radagast, it barely interfered with the main story. Radagast was the main vehicle of the necromancer plot in film one. And the Radagast scenes, especially the Radagast in Mirkwood scenes, were simply interruptions. It was a meanwhile, elsewhere, something totally different is happening kind of thing. When Gandalf enters into that part of the plot fully, when he turns his back on the Quest of Erebor plot and goes onto the Necromancer plot, it ceases to be just an aside, as it was with Radagast, and really begins to interfere. So it's got to become more prominent at that point. And that, therefore, my question becomes, to what extent does it become a part of the overall shape? And what I'm thinking of here is I'm thinking of the Two Towers film. In the Two Towers book, of course, the two different plane, the story splits at the end of the Fellowship of the Ring, and we've got the surviving members of the company and what's going on with them, and we've got Frodo and Sam going to Mordor. And Tolkien, of course, doesn't jump back and forth. We get book three talking about the first set and book four talking about the second set. And although we get during book four occasional glimpses back of what's going on so that we can keep them chronologically connected in our heads, the two of them are treated totally separately. Now, in the film, Jackson didn't do this, and he goes back and forth. And not only does he just go back and forth and continue telling the two stories in parallel, he does an interesting job of sort of pairing the two of them together so that it doesn't seem like these are just two totally unrelated stories that happen to be being told in the same film. And in particular, I thought a bunch of people... I was mentioned in a Twitter exchange by several listeners just yesterday about sort of gripings about the films. This because sort of a what is your least favorite scene in the Lord of the Rings films conversation broke out yesterday on Twitter, and several of them were complaining about the Osgiliath scene at the end of the Two Towers Frodo and Sam being taken to Osgiliath and everything. And I do agree that that's pretty egregious in a bunch of ways. But what I will say is that scene, and in particular, the way that Sam's speech about stories is placed within that. I don't much like at all the Faramir is taking Frodo and Sam and they get as far as Osgiliath and then let them go. I'm not a big fan of that innovation in the Two Towers film. But that the way that that works as a climax, the way that Sam's speech about stories functions and interacts with Faramir's story and with Frodo's story and with the Battle of Helm's Deep, which is also, the other half of the story, which is also concluding then, I think works really well and ties the whole thing together. The ending, as a film ending, I find it pretty satisfying. Now, again, I'm referring to all this because I'm wondering to what extent we're going to get that a similar kind of movement there when we're now splitting between the Quest of Erebor and Gandalf. I'm assuming it's going to be an uneven split, that we're going to be getting, you know, twice as much footage of the Quest of Erebor as we do, you know, Gandalf's search for answers. But even if the two stories are not actually connected, you know, like the necromancer in communication with Smaug or whatever, I think there has to be some kind of joining. Just based on what I've seen, you know, I think that he's going to be thinking about tying those together in some ways, so that the whatever resolution the two stories come to at the end of film two, it's going to work as a kind of a unified ending.
Yeah, that's true.
And therefore, so therefore this leads me to one of the big projection questions about film two. And that is, I think we should just go on record about this. Do you think the Battle of Dol Guldur is going to happen in film two or not? Is the story with the necromancer going to come to a climax in film two, or will that climax happen in film three?
I think it's going to happen in film two. I mean, again, I think we kind of talked about this before, in the sense of, I think if it happens in film three, you're taking away from the dramaticness, that's not even a word, of the Battle of Five Armies. So I think the Battle of Dol Guldur is going to be our military action for movie two.
Yeah.
Man, I don't know. You know, I have a really bad feeling about the Battle of Dol Guldur. Mm-hmm. At least if they really intend to make it big. I personally think that if they really intended to build up to a very climactic confrontation at Dol Guldur, they really should have spent more time with it in the first film. But they did nothing. Like, it's really hard to see how we can get from where we are now with Dol Guldur, which is Radagast wandered over there at one point, found a blade, saw kind of a weird shadow thing, gave it to Gandalf. Gandalf showed it to the other people. The other people brushed him off. How are we going to get from that to, oh, crap, it's Sauron, we better go attack and gather up all the armies and stuff? The only thing I can imagine, if they're going to do it, on the one hand, I really don't want them to do it in the third film, because I don't see how that would work either, because Gandalf needs to be at the Battle of Five Armies.
Right, so it has to happen before the Battle of Five Armies. Right.
So it's either in the first half of that film, which would be bizarro in terms of pacing, or it has to be in this one. But I don't see really how it works in this one either, unless they're really going to change the nature, or, well, not change the nature, because I guess we don't really know what the Battle of Dol Guldur was like. All we know about it is we have, you know, cryptic statements in the Lord of the Rings about the White Council putting forth its power and driving Sauron from there. So that doesn't even mean it was necessarily like an actual battle.
Right.
I personally think the only way I can imagine it working is if it's something like that, where it's Gandalf and Radagast and maybe Galadriel, maybe a few elves show up, fight
hedgehogs.
Like, you know, a couple ring wraiths, an army of hedgehogs. Fight a couple ring wraiths, a couple spiders, a couple goblins, and then Sauron runs away. Like, I don't think it's going to be a battle. Like, if people are expecting, like, it will be the Helm's Deep of Desolation of Smaug, I think they're going to be really disappointed.
Yeah.
There's no way Helm's Deep took up most of that movie.
Yeah.
I do think it is going to be the Helm's Deep of Desolation of Smaug, but only in the sense that it's going to be the battle. You know,
it's a battle.
Second movie.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be we got to have you know, some fighting going on, and that's what it's going to serve. You know, it's not going to be as extensive as Helm's Deep, but I think it's going to serve that function. And Corey and I kind of talked about this, or I actually brought it up when Corey and I were talking before the show. It's like, we actually don't know. I mean, just because in the book it's kind of loose, and I believe it's even like they don't really even see Sauron, that he's basically the Nazgul sort of are the front. They kind of defend Dol Guldur as a cover to let Sauron get away in the book. that may not be the way it is in Jackson's universe. I mean, we have had some media about the fact that Cumberbatch is going to be seen as Sauron, and there's been sort of intimations that there's some Sauron scenes. Doesn't necessarily have to be in the battle, but it's quite possible there will be kind of a confrontation between the, you know, white and black directly, that we will see Sauron in the battle. I don't know. I mean, it could go so many different ways, this battle, because it's all made up.
You know, now Kate Neville makes a suggestion here, which I think is pretty sensible. She thinks that the death of Smaug is going to be the end of the first film, and the second film, and the third film will start with the Battle of Dol Guldur. I agree that having the Battle of Dol Guldur happening in parallel with, or even in close proximity to, the Battle of Five Armies would be a bad idea from a narrative point of view. The fact that Gandalf has to get on the express train between the two doesn't bother, I don't think, is any impediment, as we see people cross massive distances very quickly in Peter Jackson films. So I don't think that that's a necessary impediment to having them be relatively close together. However, I don't think thematically the two of them are going to be working nearly as well. I don't think we're going to want to be distracting because of the way the Battle of Five Armies has such a buildup to it. I mean, in order for the tensions and, you know, Thorin going away and, you know, going to his unhappy place and you know, the armies gathering and the exchange of demands and the tensions and the handing over of the Arkenstone and all of these things, the buildup of the siege is really crucial, and I can't imagine we're going to be interrupting that with, meanwhile, action down in Mirkwood. I don't think that's going to happen. So I agree with Kate that if it does happen in film three, it's got to be at the beginning, as sort of a transition into it. But you know, I kind of like the idea of the Battle of Dol Guldur in parallel with the conflict with Smaug, not necessarily parallel in the sense of flipping back and forth, you know, between scenes of like dragon combat and Dol Guldur combat or anything like that. But that is, again, just sort of thinking thematically, there's a neat kind of mirror reversal of Smaug coming out of his mountain and attacking Esgaroth and being fought off. And, you know, the forces of good coming and invading Mirkwood and attacking Dol Guldur. You know, there's a kind of symmetry there that I find really appealing. And I don't know that just because I find that symmetry appealing doesn't mean that that's necessarily how it's going to happen in the film. But that does sort of strike me as interesting. I kind of think we might get the culmination with the Battle of Dol Guldur. I mean, whatever of the Battle of Dol Guldur is going to happen, I think it may well happen in film two. I'm kind of thinking, because even thinking of, Trish, of what you were just saying about having fighting in this film, between the apparently remarkable combat sequence that the barrel ride has turned into and the attack of Smaug on Esgaroth, there's not many action scenes, are there? Or any?
No, I don't think so.
Action scenes? Other than maybe some dwarf goblin or some dwarf dragon action on the sides of the Lonely Mountain. So I wonder if that could be, you know, basically while they are in Lake Town, and while they are coming to, maybe we even have sort of a parallel of, you know, Gandalf approaching Dol Guldur as they are approaching the Lonely Mountain kind of thing. So I could definitely see the Battle of Dol Guldur happening in film two. I think I'm actually rooting for it to happen in film two.
I think I am too,
so
actually.
That it not be obstructing the Battle of Five Armies.
Exactly.
We still have plenty of room for denouement at the end. You know, it.
Do you,
yeah.
Do you think we have enough time in the film to sort of build up the head of steam, the narrative head of steam that would lead to a battle?
Well, I mean, this just gets back to the problems that we've seen all the way along. You know, there is so much stuff to do in film two. How are they ever possibly going to do it all?
It still astounds me that these are the conversations we're having about.
I know, really.
When in the lead up to it, people are like, how will they ever make films out of that?
Oh, yeah, what a stretch.
There's nothing there.
Yeah. But
listen, one of the Riddles in the Dark listeners, and I apologize that I don't remember who it was, but did sort of an analysis of an unexpected journey in terms of the time chunks, and there were a significant number of 20-minute blocks in an unexpected journey. Those sort of overshadowed all the others. I mean, there was a couple that were maybe 5 minutes, one was maybe 2 minutes, but the big scenes, and I'll see if I can go back and find this thing, you know, like the exposition at the beginning and, you know, all the pieces, 20 minutes was kind of the standard chunk. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I mean, we could kind of apply that formula, perhaps.
20 minutes of Bilbo standing and looking around an empty bag end. just evil.
Well, like, yes, Conversation of Smaug could be a 20-minute, or the, you know, pieces of Bilbo going in and out of the mountain and interacting with the dragon, if there's more than one, could be a 20-minute section. Esgaroth could be a 20-minute section. The frickin' barrel ride could be a 20-minute section. Please,
oh,
spare me. So I just thought that was an interesting statistic that we could play around with.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if we think of it in terms of just doing a really quick overview of what needs to be covered, thinking of the Quest of Erebor plot, and, you know, tell me if I'm leaving anything out, we have the encounter with Beorn and moving from there to set out into Mirkwood. We need to have a Mirkwood is scary sequence culminating in the spiders, but also apparently including the bewitchment of Bomber somehow, since we're going to be carrying him. As I still can scarcely believe we saw that image. And if it had not been for that one still that we saw, I would be ready to swear up and down that the enchanted sleep of Bomber is certainly going to be cut out.
Well, that's also that it could show up in a, well, that's true. I was going to say it could still show up in an extended edition.
Possibly. But anyway, okay, so we've got the Beorn encounter. We've got the scary Mirkwood and spiders encounter. We've got the captured by the Elven King and imprisoned by the Elven King. We've got the escape from the Elven King leading up to the barrel ride and the fight apparently with
you left out the languishing in the Elven King's dungeons for months.
While we have lots of discussions among
Bilbo Toria, runs around invisible.
Yeah. Yes. No, you're right. I mean, that basically needs to be included too. Then you've got the move into Lake Town, meeting Bard and the master of Lake Town, and, you know, what goes on in Lake Town. Then you've got the going to the Lonely Mountain and discovering the secret door. Then you've got the going down into the mountain in conversations with Smaug. And then possibly combat with Smaug and ultimately the death of the dragon at Esgaroth if we get that.
And somewhere in there we've got Gandalf being jumped on by a dwarf.
Right.
Visiting the Nazgul tombs.
Right. But thinking of those in order, we've got Gandalf's departure and him going to find answers, which I assume means he's going to the tombs of the Nazgul, which I still don't fully understand, but anyway, there we are. So Gandalf meeting Radagast at the tombs of the Nazgul, and then we've got Gandalf going from there to Dol Guldur, which I think is in a different place. Again, the geography a little bit uncertain, but anyway, so that we've got then Gandalf going with Radagast, presumably, and probably Sebastian, to Dol Guldur, and encountering the person that he encounters there. And then what? You know, here, Dave, I'm thinking of your, you know, narrative head of steam. What else do we get of that? Galadriel's involved, right? We know this?
We know Galadriel's going to be in the Battle of Dol Guldur because of what Philippa said, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, and to backtrack, Ian and Kate both remind us that Jackson has said that that he actually is having a direct confrontation between the dwarves and the dragon.
Right.
Probably
right.
On the side of the mountain.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. So if we're going to have more buildup to Dol Guldur, we've got to have somehow Gandalf discovers that the Nazgul are gone, and thereafter probably that's the point at which he begins to be suspicious that this necromancer dude might be either the Witch King or Sauron or somebody. And so that's when he decides, okay, I got to go and check this out myself. So he's going to go and check it out himself. But it's at that point that the whole thing really collapses. How does he get from, let me go and see if maybe this is Sauron or the Witch King or somebody, to, I'm sending up the Galadriel signal and we're going in, we're going to go like put the boots on and go after him. I don't know, unless we get basically, if that is Thran, of which I'm still in doubt. The crazy dude that he's fighting with, then presumably that could be the thing that fills in the gap, that how Gandalf discovers, okay, yeah, this is Sauron, you know, that this guy can tell him stuff, which leads Gandalf to be quite clear of what's going on. But then what? At that point, does Gandalf have to, I mean, I keep joking about sending up the Galadriel signal. Does he have to go to Lothlorien? Does he have to send word to her somehow? Do we get another little council? You know, do we get like Radagast and Gandalf and Galadriel sitting around and saying, okay, do you want to go? Yeah, okay, do let's. And then they take off to go fight Sauron. And then we
maybe
get
Radagast swings by Lothlorien and picks up Galadriel on his rabbit sled.
Exactly, since he seems to be capable of crossing almost infinite distances in almost negligible
That's
amount
right.
of time. He clearly
of
is
course,
the one to send.
He will take a very erratic route getting to Dol Guldur, judging by.
Right, exactly. You will drive around in circles very fast along the way. However, I certainly agree, you know, when sort of sketching through the plots as we, you know, based upon what we know from the book and what we know from the film, there's a lot of holes in that Dol Guldur plot. And
there is. It's a real wild card.
So either they're going to fill them, which means they're going to take more time than we think, and somehow all the rest of that stuff has to get squeezed into a comparatively small hole, you know, small package, or they're not going to fill them and it's going to be really sketchy. And those kind of seem to me to be the only real
options. How long do we think this movie's going to be, by the way?
8 hours, I'm thinking.
How long was Two Towers? Two Towers was longer than Fellowship of the Ring, wasn't it?
Yes, they each get longer. The original.
How are they ever going to make a film out of The Hobbit?
It's just a children's book.
An entire film. Come on.
Yeah. No, there's really nothing there.
And two films? Oh, two films. Oh, come on. Two films? Really? Oh, that's just the studio trying to make money.
Yeah, they're just trying to make money making two films.
Yep.
There's hardly enough material for one film, much less two. God forbid they should even try to extend it into three. Then they'll just be really reaching.
Yeah, absolutely. Thinking of all this, though, this brings us towards, and we have to get towards, our final question.
Yes.
Which is, given all this stuff, where are we going to end? What is going to be the culmination of this story? Where is this going to go? And, you know, we don't really have time today to finish thinking through where this is going to go for all, you know, for each of the characters individually. But where is it going to go for the story as a whole? What is going to be the ending point, the satisfying ending point of this second film? And that's our question. I suppose we should give our options here officially. Okay. So that's our riddle. How do we actually phrase the riddle? What's the final thing? I forgot.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'll be with you. After which major plot event the second film end.
Okay, after which major plot event will the second film end? So notice we're not talking about, what is going to be the final thing on screen or something like that.
Right.
So the correct answer for film one would have been the out of the frying pan into the fire sequence. Fight with the goblins and wargs in the burning trees. That is the answer for film one as far as like what is the last major plot event, the culminating plot event of the film. And so the options are option A is the death of the dragon. Now I chose option A to be that because, of course, as our regular listeners know, option A is always the book answer, and I'm pointing that to as the book answer for the reasons that I explained before, that the death of the dragon is the moment of the transition, is that other moment, that really significant moment of transition for the Hobbit book. So if there's a book answer to the question of where film two will end, that in my mind, that's got to be it. So the death of the dragon is option A. Option B is the dragon's departure for Esgaroth. So this is, maybe there's the conflict with the dwarves and the dragon on the mountainside or whatever, but it's not the I mean, I'm thinking here of the ending of chapter 12 in the book, when Smaug comes out and smashes the mountainside, and then says, "I don't know your smell, but if you are not one of those men of the lake, you had their help. They shall see me and remember who is the real king under the mountain." He rose in fire and went away south towards the running river. Roll credits. That's B. Option C is... Oh, wait, I'm forgetting. What was option C?
Battle of Dol Guldur.
The Battle of Dol Guldur, right. That we're going to end... It's not going to be a Smaug-focused ending at all. The Battle of Dol Guldur is going to be the culminating moment of film two. Option D is the Siege of the Lonely Mountain.
Right? By the Men and Elves. Yeah.
Yeah, by the Men
and
Elves.
By the Men and Elves.
That is, we're going to have the dragon will be dead, and we're not going to end the film with the death of the dragon, but we're actually going to end it with an establishment of the tension that is going to lead up to the Battle of Five Armies at the end. So we'll have the death of the dragon, and then we'll have we'll see like the armies of elves and men moving toward the mountain, or setting up around the mountain or something. At the end. And then option D. That is option D. Okay. That is option D.
Well, yeah.
Option E
we have to put in.
Something
right?
different.
Something completely different.
Something completely different.
None of the above.
None of the above. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just to help out the judges in case we've left them in the lurch.
This is the kind of riddle where we have to give a none of the above option because there's no reason to think that our four options are completely inclusive. So those are options again. Option A, the death of the dragon. Option B, the departure of the dragon from the mountain for Esgaroth. Option C is the Battle of Dol Guldur. And option D is the Siege of the Lonely Mountain by the armies of men and elves. So,
I have been all along a big fan of the Smaug leaves for Esgaroth answer. Mm-hmm. And I may still go for that, but one of the things that I'm remembering as folks are reminding me of things that have gone before in the logs and whatnot is we've been told that in the extended edition of An Unexpected Journey, we're going to get a scene of Geryon and his black arrows trying to fight off the dragon when he arrives at Dale. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, if we wait until movie 3 for Bart and his black arrow, the audience may not, or at least Jackson will consider that the audience won't have enough memory to remember back to Geryon in the extended edition. So I am kind of tending toward maybe Bard will kill Smaug with his arrow at the end of movie 2. So I'm not going to give an answer yet, but I just want to go on record as saying I'm now rethinking my original position.
What do you guys think about the Dol Guldur sequence battle, whatever it is? happening in parallel with the confrontation with Smaug.
I like it. I guess that's what I think works out.
You're talking about the Ezgaroth confrontation or the dwarves confrontation?
I kind of like the idea of ending film two. Part of the reason I'm bringing this up is I wanted to ask what we're going to call it if this happens. I kind of like the idea of film two ending with us poised on the precipice of two major conflicts: Smaug attacking Ezgaroth, and the White Council attacking Dol Guldur.
And neither resolved yet.
Yeah, neither resolved yet. And then film three starts off with a bang with both of those things. And then we resolve them, tie them up, Gandalf heads for the Lonely Mountain, and then the rest of film three is going into the Battle of Five Armies.
No.
Well, first of all, no, I'm thinking that B should probably be Smaug attacks Ezgaroth as opposed to Smaug leaves for Ezgaroth.
Well, no, because then, I mean, that sort of then suggests that we'd be ending the film, like, in the middle of it. In the middle of the fight. I mean, I feel like if we get Smaug setting fire to Ezgaroth, then, like, we've got to finish it, right? I mean, we're not going to... Surely the credits aren't going to roll then, right?
No. I don't mean that. I mean, like, basically Smaug departing the mountain. So, basically, what happens if we get B and C, like, the setup for both those confrontations? Smaug leaving for Ezgaroth, Battle of Dol... You know, White Council marching on Dol Guldur. What happens if we're... splicing or like sort of switching back and forth between those two scenes.
I like that, except there's no way that's going to happen. Or that is, there's no way that we're going to end the film only setting them up and not happening. Now, here's what I could see. What I can see is the two of those encounters actually happening, that the end of film two becomes this really climactic moment, which is actually kind of awesome, where when the credits roll at the end of film two, everywhere, the good guys have won. Hooray! They've kicked the Necromancer out of Dol Guldur. Like, the good guys have defeated, and evil is on the run. The dragon comes out on attack. Oh, we've killed the dragon. Now the dragon is dead. And so the end of film two is like, hooray! All the bad guys are defeated. It's all pretty much over now. And evil...
Why would I come back to a third movie, though?
Good is triumphant. But that of course then is what sets up like what happens later, because again, that's actually very much the motion of things in the book. And the whole like sort of point of Bilbo's outrage is that like, look, you know, this is not just that it's supposed to be over, you know, the good guys were supposed to have won, and now we get, after that, we get all of this complication of who really are the good guys, and, you know, are we going to fight among ourselves, and how are we going to handle
that? Okay, well, then here's another question for you, then. If that actually happened, to me, to set up for movie three, then we got to have basically Bilbo's thinking it's over, and then, you know, and then, oh my God, it's not, which to me would mean they look out from the Lonely Mountain and see... The field is full of tents and armored men and elves.
Would that be
considered a major event? That wouldn't really be a major event. That wouldn't be the siege of the Lonely Mountain, would it?
That's D.
Is it? Okay.
That's exactly the rationale of the D answer, to say that the film three has to end, or film two has to end, with the establishment of the tension that's going to break out in film three in the Battle of Five Armies.
Okay.
Corey...
Golly, now you're opening me up to another answer, because I can see that happening.
That's the answer. Exactly.
Oh, boy.
Now, of course, if the final sequence of the film really is Dol Guldur and the death of Smaug happening at the same time, then I think we just basically have to give credit to everybody who guessed either one of those things, as we don't. I mean, if they really are doing them in parallel, that would be the only fair way to do it, I think.
Is to make them both right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But see, that's why I do think that now here's I will give my negative for D. That is, the in my mind, the top reason for not voting D is simply that it's the furthest downstream of all four options.
That's my problem too.
I mean, we have to get really pretty far along to get there, and I'm not sure we're going to go that far. I mean, I think that that idea has to happen. Clearly, I mean, because as you were saying, Trish, if it looks like all of the good guys have won and all of the major plots have been resolved, then it's going to be a little bit funny. Oh, but by the way, there is a third film for some reason. You know, so that's got to make sense internally, but I don't think that the actual advance to the siege has to occur for that to happen. It would be one very good, a very dramatic way to make that happen, but it doesn't have to be. They don't have to be sort of completely going there.
So I forget.
Now we could see. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify, in case I missed this. If in fact the film ends with both these things happening, Dol Guldur and Dragon leaving, that kind of stuff, what are we calling that? Is that B or C?
Both.
I think it's both, isn't it? Yeah, we have to give credit to both.
So that's C.
I know.
All right.
Well, the judges probably have to determine if it's...
I think we'd have to, depending on how it goes off in the film, the judges would have to decide whether
they
wanted to award credit for both B and C or whether they would want to call it something different.
Ah.
Now, here's another question I've got. I would imagine that we could conceivably see the mustering of men and elves in their various locations, getting ready to go to the mountain, and that would not be considered the siege, right? We're just seeing the preparation for the siege. And it wouldn't necessarily be, so that wouldn't necessarily be the major event. Like the dragon could die and we could see the muster, but the muster wouldn't be the major event.
Yes. Okay. No, I agree. If we have, Brian was just suggesting he'd love to see the end of film two being a sequence of the news of the dragon's death spreading. I actually really kind of like that. But that would be basically, the answer would be A, if that happened.
Right.
The spreading of the news is not itself a major plot event. The culminating moment would be the death of the dragon. But that would be kind of cool, to have, the Elven King gets the news.
I can see Thranduil going, awesome, let's go get us some gold.
That's right. I hear they've got lots of silver and white gems. Let's go. And then you've got Bjorn hearing about it and the goblins hearing about it.
And the moth.
And the moth hearing about it, the moth bringing the word to Gandalf, and all these things. Yeah, so that would be cool. That would be cool. But again, that would certainly be an A answer. Even if we were to get, and I would specify this, I think that even if we get, the people, the death of the dragon, and somebody at Lake Town saying we should go to the Lonely Mountain and claim the treasure, and Thranduil saying, "Okay, guys, let's go. Let's form up an army and get out there." That's still not the D answer. The D answer has to be like the armies show up at the Lonely Mountain. Like the final sequence is the besieging of the Lonely Mountain by the armies. So just the mobilization of people, not enough.
Good luck with this question, judges.
Hey, that's part of the fun of being a judge.
And just be forewarned, judges, whatever you choose, I'm going to say you're wrong.
Exactly. Well, Dave, I think they all will assume that no matter what. So I think it's kind of a given.
That'll be part of the judge. Yeah.
That's part of the fun of being a judge.
Exactly.
That's how we'll brief them. When the judges get together and we do like a little debrief of them before they go off, we'll say, that'll be one of the last things we say. And just understand, judges, whatever you do, Dave, it'll be wrong.
Prepare to be quibbled with by Dave no matter what your results are.
After you receive 20 pages of notes from him. Just wait for our last chance.
trying to sway your answers.
Yeah, that's right. Trying to very subtly do it. I'm not trying to sway your answers. Just read all of this.
No.
He's like, I'm not trying to sway your answers. Just let me give you the background of why we selected these as answers and what the rationale behind each one of these is.
Very carefully explain exactly what we meant so that you feel compelled to pick the answer.
Yeah, exactly. Good. It's very helpful.
Dave, you are coming to Mythmoot this year, aren't you? I mean, that's a sort of a side question, but are you going to be able to come to Mythmoot?
It actually looks pretty good. Okay, I don't have any,
we're not doing Riddles in the Dark there, but...
I don't have any conference deadlines around then, unlike last year, so it's looking pretty good, actually.
Oh, good, okay. All right, I'll keep a, keep my fingers crossed. I'm going to step out and give an answer here, and I need to do this fast. It's like taking a Band-Aid off a cut. You know, right. I need to do it quick. I'm actually going to go with A. I've changed my mind. All this time, I thought I was a B girl. Yeah. All this time. But the more we talk about it, the more I think about the story arc. I'm glad we actually did the whole story arc. I'm thinking it's going to be A, so I'm going on record to say.
So you don't break dance.
I know, that's right. I do a mean rumba, though, Mr. Dance.
That's true. So I've heard. if we both make it to Myth Moot, we're going to have to find
out. Oh, yeah, outside we got to do that. Yeah, that's right. Because Dave's a dancer.
I'm going with I don't know what I'm supposed to pick for this. I'm going with what I think is going to happen is BC. I'm in the category of people who thinks it'll end with setting both those things up. So I don't know if I should just pick one. But actually, I think in my opinion, the main thing, the important thing, is B. I'm a big fan of these of Smaug flying off. Yes, I am a B-boy. I hope they use the line that you quoted earlier, Corey, about Smaug saying that he's the king of the mountain, and that it sounds just, and that Benedict Cumberbatch can deliver it with the same gravitas that you can.
Oh boy, Cumberbatch doing that line, boy, yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose you know one of the things about the BC could be literally we're talking about after which major event. Will be able to the movie end. It'll be like of the BC, whichever was the last in the sequence would be the right answer.
Right.
You know, if it's BC, it's like which was the last one before the movie ended.
Yeah.
Well, all right, Corey. Dun, 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 dun.
The fact is, I think it's going to be A, and the reason I think it's going to be A is I do think that's the most satisfying ending, and what's more, the thing that really appeals to me. Is the title. if the movie ends with the death of Smaug, it gives the title, The Desolation of Smaug, a really lovely double meaning. You know, where most of the film is focused on the desolation that has been created by Smaug. And then the film culminates in the destruction of the dragon and his own desolation. And that's kind of nifty. I think that one little piece is probably swaying me unduly. The Battle of Dol Guldur, I'm also tempted by. I can totally see the sequence that I described of having them both happening at the same time. I also kind of like Kate Neville's idea of ending with the death of Smaug and starting film 3 with the Battle of Dol Guldur. Having Gandalf and Radagast and Galadriel getting, like, basically having that plot end in film 2 with some kind of like mini council of war, you know, where we have them around a small table and, you know, we've got four chairs at the table, of course, for Gandalf and Radagast and Galadriel and Sebastian the Hedgehog. And the four of them decide they're going to get together and they're going to go and attack. But it doesn't happen in film 2, and then we get that happening at the beginning of film 3. Can totally see that. Would not be surprised to see the Battle of Dol Guldur coming at the end of. in many ways, I think that as far as story arc goes, I would find it most satisfying to have the Dol Guldur plot actually resolved in film 2, because that makes Gandalf's return to Erebor for the Battle of Five Armies. That makes that just kind of make more sense and be more satisfying. So that it doesn't sound like so that it doesn't seem like a side trip for Gandalf, you know, that like, you know, he's gotta make the trip and arrive just in the nick of time, but rather having resolved that, now he's going to come back and you know, help to take care of what's going on, you know, what is threatening to go on up at the Lonely Mountain, as everything is going off the rails without him.
Of course, actually, Kate's idea could, you know, is also good here, too, because if we do the death of the dragon,
yeah,
which, you know, could still be the answer A for our question, but you still have to do something to build up the reason to buy a ticket for movie 3. I could literally see, you know, the last scene of the movie being like Gandalf drawing Glaurung, yay, drawing Glamdring, you know, and heading into battle in Dol Guldur is like the last
right
scene
out of
the movie.
His pocket.
I got dragons on my mind here. But I don't know that that would necessarily be
one
the last
those,
major
like,
event of movie 2, but
yeah,
the Glauron pencil eraser.
yeah. Well, he must have one of those little bags like Hermione does in Harry Potter.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Name,
and you just, yeah. You know, Harry reach Poppins. In there and just, yeah. Just start pulling Glauron out little by little.
I see. John says, I think the dragon will be dead. The camera will go to the forces at the gate of Dol Guldur, ending there, hinting there is more to come
right.
even after the dragon's death. So that
That's
would be
what
C.
Saying.
No, that would be, I would call that A. Because
so
we're ending with a setup for the Battle of Dol Guldur, but the final event of the film was the death of the dragon. So yeah, I mean, I'm assuming we're not, I mean, since this is a second film and there is a third film to come, there has to be some kind of link forward to the third film that happens at the very end. That's
right.
Why the premise of this riddle is not what is the very, very last sequence going to be, the very last thing seen on camera. That's how we talked about it when we did our riddle back in last season. But the reason why I'm not doing that this time is I want to be focusing on what is the climactic, where is the plot of the plot trajectory of film two, where does it end? Where is it going to? Where does it culminate? And then given
and in
that,
using
you have
your-
to have some denouement after that to
right.
spring to, you know, springboard into film three.
Well, and in using your example of if we had applied this riddle to movie one, the answer would have been the fight in the
yes.
fir trees.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and the answer to the answer to this riddle for the Fellowship of the Ring film would be the death of Boromir, I would say.
Right.
Even though, of course, the departure of Frodo and Sam is important, and the scene, you know, the film ends with, you know, Frodo and Sam looking across the Emyn Muil, I think that clearly the death of Boromir is the climactic moment in the Fellowship of the Ring film. So that's why
Dave has to go.
Yep.
Dave has to go. Tick,
Dave
tick, tick,
go.
Tick.
Yep.
So did you vote, Dave, officially?
Yes.
B,
yes,
right?
Yes, in a couple minutes.
B,
so
okay.
You guys are A, I'm B.
We haven't
we'll
had too many of the listeners
out.
haven't
John Lambert, John asked if it was an A. Yeah, no, but Brianna says she has to think about it more.
Yana says that he apparently, if we're allowed to pick multiple answers, he's choosing A, B, C, D.
No. Go on now. We must commit.
Oh, it looks like John has committed to A. Bravo.
Yeah, Brianna is not going to commit to anything. She's going to think about it.
Oh, okay. Yana said B. Yana's a B boy.
Okay. All right. I think we have some. I think we have some new people here today. Anybody else want to be voting? You should.
It's leaning A. Okay.
Enter it into the questions box if you would like to register your vote. Oh boy! Lots
but then,
of
if you want to wait until we get it up on the Facebook page, yeah, I know they are. Yeah.
Oh, Carissa changed
your
mind.
B.
Joined
okay,
back
good.
To A. Carissa, you were a D before, weren't you? Did I talk you out of it? Okay. Paul says A. That's right. That's good. Ian says B. So far, Carissa was a D previously, but I think I talked her out of D.
By the way, Sharon reminds me, and this will be pertinent to the podcast listeners as well, is Facebook has changed the way it does polls on pages. And so at least for now, it looks like the only solution I've been able to come up with is to actually use a little applet for polls. And the thing is, I know a lot of people, I would not want to, if I wasn't actually running the page, I wouldn't do it, which is that Facebook, to use it, then Facebook says, well, can Facebook have your permission to, like, you know, have your firstborn male child?
Yeah.
So I realize a lot of people aren't going to want to give Facebook that permission. So if you don't want to participate in the poll applet on Facebook, just keep track of your answers. And if we come up with another solution, we'll let you know. Or worst case is you can send us your list of answers at the end of the game.
Yeah, no, that's so gosh, wait, Facebook just randomly changed something? I can't believe that.
Yes,
that
I went on to
character.
Do it. Yeah, just seems so out of character. And I believe this is to monetize something.
Right.
Yeah, they did it in a way to compel you to give up more personal information, I'm sure.
Right, and to pay extra for, like, having a version with no ads, you know, it's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
So I did notice somebody saying that they've changed the like feature on pages to be more of a poll. I got to go back and research that and see if something changes to where we can still do the polls without having to give away stuff to Facebook.
Actually,
what if we
no,
just
that's
post,
true.
What if we just do a What if we just do a separate post for each answer, and then people vote on it by liking it?
And then
we could do.
Yes, exactly. But I was just thinking the same. No, of course we can't.
Yeah. Work.
Can we? It does keep track of who were the people who liked it.
That'll just make me take longer to do them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that'll be good too because Stephen will be able to, you know, compile the individual winners that way as well. I mean, the other thing about this poll applet, it makes it more difficult to know who did, you know, who's voting. So I may do that. That's actually a good idea, Dave. I'll go back and look at that, and if so, I'll change the ones that are already up there as applets back to, you know.
Still
going
to make it really tough to get to a spreadsheet, though.
Well, it'll show at least who the likes were. I mean, it'll give us a list of people.
Yeah, it gives a
same
list.
Same way that the poll thing did.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's what Stephen had to work with before, too. So, yeah, anyway, I just want to let folks know that just do keep track of your answers so whatever we end up doing, you remember what it was
May also be time to look into maybe putting this on the Mythgard website instead.
Instead of Facebook? Gosh, I don't know. Facebook is so reliable. That's my problem.
And trustworthy, too.
Yeah. I mean, if there's one thing you can count on in life is that Facebook will...
Facebook,
never...
staying the same.
Exactly.
Always being, you know,
it's like a rock
for the
life,
for the little guy.
You know?
Really.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so I just want to let you guys know that. And just stay tuned for, you know... Yana, the Mythgard website, not the Mythgard Institute school site.
Talking
about the Mythgard website.
The course pages and stuff are password protected.
Yeah.
That was
the other thing. Oh, that we're doing another freebie Two Towers class today, and this will live for a while. So on the podcast, it's still working. It was really fun. Corey, Dave, I don't know if you've noticed this, but Corey came up with an index that only somebody with astrophysics background would have thought of in relation to Tolkien. Corey, can you explain it real quick?
Did you hear about my Turin scale, Dave?
No, I would like to hear this.
Okay, yeah. So the idea is that all bad decision making in Tolkien can be given a numerical value, with the unit of measure for bad decision making being the Turin.
Turin.
So like a one.
Yes, the number of Turins.
a 1.0 Turin decision would be you refuse the pardon of King Thingol and refuse to return to Doriath when you've been invited to come back. That's like a 1.0 Turin decision. Whereas, of course, like refusing the urging of Ulmo to cast down the bridge into Nargothrond would be a much more like a five. That's like a five Turin decision, and then of course you can rate all bad decision making on the Turin scale. Then, so you can rate. You know, what were some of the other examples I came up with? Like, Frodo, Sam, and Merry and Pippin stopping to have a picnic by a standing stone in the Barrow Downs would be something like a 15 centiturin decision. You know, not really high in the scope, really just foolish and short-sighted. In order to really rank on the Turin scale, there has to be not only foolishness, but real arrogance combined with disastrous consequences for lots of other people.
You made Denethor looking into the Palantir like a 15 Turin.
Oh yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd go as high as 15. Because I think I ranked Ar-Pharazôn deciding to take Sauron back
a
prisoner. I think I rated that a 10 Turin.
Right.
That's definitely a 10 Turin.
Yeah.
Now, then somebody came up with the Gandalf. a Gandalf being what appears to be a Turin decision, but turns out to be catastrophic. An example being, let's go through Moria to get to the other side of the mountains. Oops, Balrog. Oh, but Gandalf the White.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. 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 No, Gandalf does have his sort of his own scale there, because that's true.
Nothing. At least in hindsight, nothing Gandalf does is that we're allowed to judge.
Exactly.
Is it really a Turin decision? Yes.
Yes. Maybe that's a separate scale, making a decision that appears to be bad, but is actually really perfectly in tune with sort of the larger,
right.
With the music and the story, that's clearly destined to probably work out for the best. That's a Gandalf.
That's right.
Well, of course, somebody came up with there has to be a Tuor scale for the good decisions, you know, is a Tuor, would be the Tuor.
Yep.
But I wrote, I said, where else would you get this kind of conversation in relation to Tolkien but from Corey Olson? I mean, this is one of the charms of the Tolkien professor.
Well, it came up in the first two Towers class, because we were talking about, you know, I spent most of the time in the first class talking about decision making, and especially Aragorn's choice, you know, Boromir's redemption in his death in the first chapter, and Aragorn's choices and how he's all worried that all of his choices are going amiss. And so it was very spontaneous, because I was just like, you know, talking about Aragorn making bad choices, but I wanted to say, like, well, but they're not really bad. I mean, in the big scale of things, like,
that's right.
You know, his choice, you know, I spent some time in class talking about his choice not to pursue Frodo back when he sees Frodo's tracks returning from Emon Hen, and he doesn't go back, and he decides instead, I really want to go up and look and sit on Emon Hen and hopefully get some guidance in my perplexities. And that's clearly the wrong thing to do. And so, like, while he's up there and seeing nothing, by the way, and receiving no help at all in his perplexities, Frodo and Sam are getting away, Boromir's being killed, you know, and there's like Aragorn sitting up there by himself accomplishing nothing. It was clearly the wrong choice, but it's not like a big bad choice, you know. So that's where it came from.
just a handful of Turins.
That's like three or four.
You gave it like
milli
a
Turins. Yeah,
half a Turin. Yeah,
yeah. No, not even
a fraction of a Turin.
That's just a few milli Turins. No more than that.
My new favorite listener is Molly Hester, who's attempting to combine the Turin scale with the Turing test.
Yes.
She said, if you can't tell if you've artificially made the decision or just made human error, you rank it on the Turing bar.
Yeah, Turing. That's awesome.
Very good. Very good.
See, here we are. We're exemplifying the benefits of a liberal arts education.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what a liberal arts education is all about.
There you go. There you go.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, gosh, we don't have a whole lot of time. I know we've gone over with Dave now. We're going to mention the telethon.
Yeah, even if it has no practical implications, the liberal arts degree certainly is great for coming up with awesome jokes.
It's just how it enriches
your life.
Oh,
awesome.
Oh,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's just that.
Well, you look at most of the memes on Facebook are, you know, have some kind of geek basis to them. I mean, if you don't have some, you know, or you know, liberal arts geek basis, I mean, you would totally not get them.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, I should go, but, you know, hey, you guys stay on the air. Keep having fun. Yep.
Bye, Dave.
I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks again for everybody who has joined. Thanks to everybody who has joined us live today, and to everybody listening. I will say, as always, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.
You would totally not get them.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, I should go, but, you know, hey, you guys stay on the air. Keep having fun. Yep,
bye, Dave.
I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks again for everybody who has joined. Thanks to everybody who has joined us live today, and to everybody listening. I will say, as always, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.